Hello and welcome to the Four Wheel Dive Podcast. I'm Tim Masso. He's Kyle Lindsay, YouTube's original King of Cars. The podcast starts now. And we are back as children of the 90s. We hold this era near and dear to our hearts. Kyle.
Absolutely.
Which is your first favorite 90s car? And tell me why.
Oh, gosh. There's just so many awesome ones to choose from. Some of mine are, pretty typical, but some of mine are also a little weird, I guess you could say. Or maybe weird to some people, but I think they're all cool. I guess right off the bat, I'd probably say the 96 Impala SS, Chevy Impala SS, is probably one of my favorites, just because it marked the end of the big-bodied GM rear-wheel drive sedans, which I like big sedans. It's just kind of always been my thing, and the fact that you had a detuned version of the Corvette's LT1, and it was all blacked out. 96 being the last year, he had some cool things like the floor shifter and upgraded speedometer with the tachometer and all that kind of stuff. Just a really cool car, and it's you still see them around my area some, but finding one that's like really clean is getting a little few and far between.
Yeah, and I definitely see the appeal of that. It was the end of an era, body on frame performance, live axle rear. It had the LT1 from the Corvette, but it was tuned more for low end torque. If you think about it, its 260 horsepower rating, SAE net, is probably as much as any Impala SS from the golden era. Like in real terms, it's probably the same.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of reflecting on this, and I'm going to start my list chronologically right at the beginning of the 90s, a car that was born of the 80s. Now, we all know about the Corvette ZR1 from the C4 generation. We all know about the LT1s and later the Grand Sports. But the one that I really want is the Callaway regular production option B2K twin turbo.
Ooh, there you go.
I don't know where this sits. It was sold through Chevy dealers. It was technically a Callaway project. It came with a full warranty. But here's the deal. It passed all the same durability standards that a regular L98 would have gone through. But the engine was blueprinted, matched, balanced, decked, honed, all of this good stuff to make in its final version 402 horsepower and 582 pound-feet of torque. You can ZR1 all day long. Forget the Lotus. I'm taking the B2K.
That is awesome. I didn't even know it was that in-depth.
Yeah, and the cool thing about it was it did feel and look like a different car. Longtime Callaway designer Paul Deutschman did a full aero body that was based on the Sledgehammer, the speed record car. Dymag wheels made of magnesium. That was a big deal back then.
Absolutely. Gosh, that's super cool. I think we're going to have to do an episode on cool car or our favorite cars from the 80s. We could probably talk about 2 to 3 episodes with that.
Well, actually, it's funny. For those of you watching the video version of the podcast, I'm wearing my Van Halen 1984 World Tour shirt right there.
Yes, so, sir.
Coming attractions for our 80s cars. Kyle, what else you got on the agenda?
Probably one of the coolest things. A couple cool things. One of the coolest things, the Plymouth Prowler. So I believe, if memory serves me correctly, the Prowler came out in 1997. And when that thing came out, it was such a radical, futuristic kind of design, but it was also very hot rod like the classic hot rods that were being built in the 30s, 40s, most likely probably in the 50s. It was just a wild car with the exposed wheels in the front and the huge rear end, and even cooler if you ordered it with the matching trailer that you could throw behind it, because there was no storage space in those cars. So the trailers are super, super cool and quite a pretty penny nowadays. Honestly, the only downside with those cars, it's like amazing concept of this car and revitalization of the hot rod, but like at the very end it was like horrible execution. Just with the V6 and the automatic, and you know, I've driven those cars before and they're a lot of fun, don't get me wrong, but it's like when you see people like Hemi swapping them, and I think somebody actually did a Hellcat swap, like that's what I'm talking about right there.
You know what it should have been? It should have been the small block V8 from the 1998 ZJ 5.9 Limited Grand Cherokee. It should have been that engine.
Oh, yes. With a manual transmission.
I mean, there was a lot to love about the Prowler. It was a cool tech showcase. There were, you know, there was magnesium. It was all aluminum. It was a transaxle. Yeah. And because it was so light, the 99 version that had the 253 horsepower, 3.5, that one actually gets up and goes decently. Like, yeah. It's like a GTI. You want 500 horsepower when you look at it.
Right, absolutely. But it's also pretty, you know, those cars are still holding their value pretty good. They're, it's interesting to see how well those perform as investments over the long term. Because, you know, people don't really care about the, quote, performance aspect of it. It's just like you said, it was a showcase of technology, showcase of materials, and a lot of that was used in future development of Chrysler products. So it's a very pivotal car for that era.
Yeah, and a cool-looking car, a fun car, but as you mentioned, not a car with a trunk that opens. So if you are in the market, look for that trailer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think I'm going to go with a car that everyone seems to love. The Prowler is very controversial, but I don't think you can have a human soul if you didn't love the 1990 to 96 Nissan Z, the Z32 generation. The ZX twin turbo to me will always be my Japanese car heartthrob. What a machine.
Absolutely. I've had the chance to drive one of those too. And I mean, for the era, the technology, I mean, you can talk, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on sweet JDM performance cars of the 90s, but you know, that one in particular, like that thing was a brute, and it was launched earlier than some of the other ones. You know, it was launched before the Mark IV Supra and all that. So, you know, it really spearheaded the whole JDM era of the 90s and stuff. But that car was a technological tour de force.
Yeah, and for me, it represents like Japan at apex, like the peak of Japan's economic might, technological might, automaking might. Japan at its peak created that Z32. It was twin turbo. It was four-wheel steering. It was remarkably streamlined. It had full light bar rear end styling. Like there was a lot that was cool about this car. And in twin turbo form, you get 300 horsepower, variable valve timing, and early use of variable valve timing, over 280 pound-feet, and it's really compact. There is a 2+2 version of that car. Don't bother with it. It's naturally aspirated. It's big. It's heavy. Go with the twin turbo. And, you know, it actually had a pretty impressive IMSA performance history. It won IMSA titles and also its class at Le Mans and Daytona. So this is actually a car that has what I always consider to be like the currency for credibility, which is success on the track.
Absolutely. And the headlights were cool enough that Lamborghini borrowed them for the Diablo. So there's that.
It was the only car of that era whose non-pop-up headlights were as cool as other cars that had.
Yes, absolutely.
There is one version of it, guys, to look for. If you ever find something called an SR71, a company called Motorsports International out of Waco, Texas, built a 486 horsepower dealer retailed version of the Z32 that changed the bodywork, vastly increased the engine power, all of this in the name of 185 mile an hour performance. This was like the twin turbo Callaway of like that 300 ZX generation. So if you ever find that, pay whatever it costs because it's worth it.
That's awesome. I've never heard of that. I'm going to look that up after we're done with this.
You're going to want to Google that one once we're done, folks.
Absolutely. Well,
what's on your brain?
I'm going to bring it back to vehicles that were not just born in the 80s, but born in the 70s and were just produced for a long time. The Chevy K5 Blazer. Specifically like the 89 through 91. So for the sake of this conversation, we're going to stick with the 91 model. I used to own an 89. So that was the fuel, the last tail end of that generation. They were fuel injected. The 91 was the best one, you know, the last year of the square body and everything. And just for some reason, there's the styling. I like that body style better a little bit than the OBS Tahoe, like two-door Tahoes that came out later. But, you know, those just had, you know, run-of-the-mill throttle body fuel injected 350. They weren't fast, but they were very utilitarian. They were built with a purpose, and they were just cool. Like, I miss that era of, like, the Blazer and the Broncos duking it out and, you know, the ability to buy just a big body on frame full size SUV. I loved that truck, and I wanted to do a project series on YouTube about it, but it had more rust that I wanted to fool with. So there's one downside of them, I guess. Finding one that doesn't have a lot of rust.
Yeah, that's always the problem with the, like, older full size trucks. No one preserves them, especially those big two-door body on frame trucks. They're unlike anything you can buy today. There's nothing like that on the market now.
Right. Now you just have the new Blazer, which is not a Blazer.
Yeah, that's not a Blazer. I'm not even sure. For those of us who grew up in like the O.J. Simpson era of the Ford Bronco, the new Bronco isn't a Bronco either.
No, it's a Ford Jeep.
Yeah, exactly.
Ford Wrangler.
I love that. Is that like old school when you had to manually lock the hubs to engage four-wheel drive?
Yes. I never tried them. They were probably frozen.
I mean, here's the thing. People love those. Like, on Bring a Trailer, if you've got one that hasn't been all beat to hell, it'll actually put up a very nice number. You'll get a good result with that.
I mean, mine, as rusty as it was, I made a couple grand off of it, so I'm not complaining.
And, you know, of course, small block Chevy, if you do want to mod, you can go crazy. Like, the sky's the limit at that point. It does have that potential.
Oh, yeah. Or just LS swap it and go to the moon.
There you go. I got a C5 Corvette down in the basement with an LS. I have trouble explaining to people that my 20-year-old Corvette has the ultimate performance engine of all time. Like, sure it does.
Yeah.
Okay. So from K5 Blazer, I'm going to step over to a TJ Wrangler. To me, this was the last Wrangler that felt like a descendant of the World War II Willys MB. It had a low belt line. It was initially only available on a short wheelbase. It was jaunty. It was light enough that the old AMC6 still felt kind of peppy in it. You know, you go with the Dana 44 axle, you've got the right combination of features for off-road riding. If you want it, if you want to mod it, you can. If you want to ride it on road, it was the first Wrangler or CJ to have coil spring suspension. So it's a little bit more compliant. And it's another one of those cars where, like, if you get it with a 5-speed manual, you get it with the 6, you get it with 4-wheel drive, you got one hell of a lot of fun because it feels faster than it is.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that. Those are climbing up in value like crazy.
And for the same reason, people beat the crap out of them. They're all rusted out. They've been rolled over off-road. They've been modded all to hell. Go ahead, find one. That's fact.
Is it not amazing how perspective has shifted significantly over the last, I mean, over the last 10 years, sure, but especially in the last 5 years, all of the stuff that we grew up, you know, idolizing and loving that people just didn't see a whole lot of value at the time. It's just a lot of it's unobtainable now. It's like one of the ones on my list, the Mark IV Supra. Forget ever owning one of those.
I blame the Fast and the Furious on that one.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, everybody knows about the Supra. I mean, it's hard to give like an intro of that car because it's just so iconic. But, you know, inline six, twin sequential turbos. I mean, it was just, even today, that car is simply stunning. And it's funny because, you know, if you're in the tuner scene and whatnot, and you hear people talking about it, you hear people talking about the amazing amount of mods and stuff that you can do to them. One, the big money is in the original cars, especially like 97, 98 Supra turbos. So if you're going to buy one, buy a naturally aspirated one and then do all your mods at that point, because the factory turbo ones are the investment cars. But I got to drive one of those too one time. It was a bone stock 95, I think, turbo, five-speed, six-speed. Gosh, I can't even remember. But it's so funny because in its original form, it drives like a pretty peppy old Toyota.
That was the generation of Supra that like ingrained in people's memory the engine code 2JZ GTE. Mm-hmm. They remembered that and they never forgot it. In the world of like Japanese performance cars, that's as like dyed in the wool and unforgettable as like the original Chevy small block or the LS1.
Right. And they were nice cars. Like you were talking about the 300ZX being a technological tour de force. You know, the Supra was as well when it came to its powertrain and stuff, but that was also a very nice car. I would consider that more of a grand touring vehicle. You know, it had the power, it was fun to drive, but Toyota took the extra steps to make it a really nice car. You know, Toyotas of the 90s in general were quite nice. A lot of people would argue that the quality was a lot better than, you know, later in the 2000s and stuff.
I would.
So that's what I meant when, you know, it drives like an old Toyota. It drives like a really nice, you know, 90s Toyota, what you would expect. It's just a really nice, well-rounded car.
It's one of those cars that kind of forced Chevrolet to make the C5 Corvette as good as it was. You know, the engineers probably got one of those. They benchmarked it like the A80 Supra. They said, look, we've got this level of chassis rigidity. We've got this level of interior noise. We put it on a 5-post rigs. We flexed it until it broke. This is how strong it is. They went into the C5 knowing that the game had changed. And I think cars like that Toyota Supra forced them to raise their game, because something like the C4 with the rattles, the squeaks, the huge step in height over the sill, that wasn't going to fly in a world where that Supra had set the baseline.
Absolutely. Super cool car.
And yet, like you said, they've kind of been discovered. So if you're looking to discover something that hasn't been discovered, I recommend like Subaru, you know, SVX. It's coming to that.
Yeah, those are cool.
So I'm going to go with another car that kind of like that Supra has been discovered. People know about the BMW 850 CSI, the closest thing we'd ever get to an E31 M8.
Was on my list too.
Okay, I'm going to let you introduce this one then. We'll share it.
So it's cool. I had the opportunity to drive so many cars for the reviews over the years, and this happens to be one of them. It was actually a dealership friend about an hour away from me that got one of these cars. I can't remember what year it was exactly. Maybe it was 95-ish, black on black. The thing about the CSI is that it was a V12 and only came in a manual. It is like one of the – it is the holy grail of the 8 series of the 90s. They are worth ridiculous money. And it is so much fun. It's exactly what you would expect out of a BMW of that era. Spectacular build quality. Like everything was soft to the touch. It was comfortable, but it was, you know, it was very business-like as well. Like just razor sharp execution, wonderful styling, wonderful build quality, wonderful drive manners. And the fact that you could shift a V12 by yourself is just something that's so hard to describe. It's amazing.
And the engine was so stout. First of all, that S70, versions of that architecture went into the Le Mans winning V12 LMR and the McLaren F1. So you've got a pedigree. But it was also just so stout. You could put that thing in fourth gear and stay in fourth gear from a stop. It had 406 pound-feet back when that was still like a – before everything was turbocharged, that was a big deal.
Right.
375 horsepower, and it's what it should have been from the beginning. Like when the E31 came out in the early 90s, you know, people had different expectations about what it was going to be. It was more of a grand tour than a lot of people had hoped. It wasn't as lively as the old Sharknose M6 had been. The M6 had less power, but that older car set like the baseline for what people wanted. And it wasn't until that, you know, 95, 96, 850 CSI that, you know, now BMW Motorsport is getting some input. And they only made about 1,500 of those S70 engines. So these things are scattered to the far corners of the world. You won't find them in large numbers anywhere. And no. Even with six figures miles on them, like even with 120,000 miles, if you have maintenance records today, that car is still worth a fortune.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because you just can't find them. They are not available.
You know, the one thing that I always regret, and BMW, by the way, the 850 CSI does have a Motorsports VIN. Motorsports was involved. There's no question about that. But there was an M8 prototype. And it's like, what could have been? It was almost 600 horsepower, almost 500 pound-feet of torque. It was like if BMW benchmarked an F40 and said, okay, this only German, that's like what that M8 was. It still exists too, one prototype.
I mean, the thing is, like, the technology that's around in the automotive industry nowadays is impressive, to say the least, but it's amazing what manufacturers were doing in the 80s and 90s to push the envelope and to just extract every single little bit without, you know, all of the widespread forced induction that we have nowadays. Like, it's just so cool how they got so creative in so many different ways. It's like, you know, one of my favorite two vehicles, I'm going to combine these, surprising vehicles of the 90s were the GMC Cyclone and the GMC Typhoon. I mean, I have not had a chance to drive either of those, and it makes me sad, especially because I have dealt so much with S10s in the last couple of years. But I mean, this was a truck. The Typhoon was the two-door based on the Jimmy, like S10 Blazer. The Typhoon was the pickup, or Cyclone was the pickup. Excuse me, got my words mixed up. But these were vehicles that were being benchmarked against Ferraris and Porsches. That 4.3-liter turbocharged V6, all-wheel drive, those things would dig into the ground and scoot. And they looked cool too. I mean, the ground effects, the limited colors that they offered. They actually had a teal color that was pretty cool. But luxurious interior, like for one of those vehicles at the time. And you know, they've definitely gone up in value quite a bit too. But just radical vehicles, like you just don't see crazy things like that near as much nowadays.
You know, it was a lot more special at the time too. You know, when you think about it today, you know, we've got Hummer EV that's got 1,000 horsepower. We've got the T-Rex. You know, we've got a new Raptor R coming. And you're like, okay, sure. Like, you have options. Back then, if you wanted to go fast in a truck, I mean, there was nothing else like this. Turbocharged, slammed, pro street. Like you said, there were some great period colors like the teal that really root it in that era. And it was a very compact vehicle. You know, it was based basically on like an S10 type platform. If you went with the GMC Cyclone, it was only 180 inches long. This was a super compact truck, and you just rolled around feeling, I have driven one. I'm happy to say I have. Oh, and sweet. You feel like you're going downhill, even when you're going uphill. It's just a very lively, spirited car. It's not super refined. Stuff rattles. It makes weird noises. But you know what? You take all that as part of the experience, and you love it for that.
Right, because you get acceleration of a Porsche and Ferrari for like a quarter of the money.
And there's not a lot out there. Yeah, you know, it's easier to find an old Porsche than it is to find a Cyclone. They made less than 3,000. I want to say they made about 4,600 Typhoons, I think. But again, they've been beaten. People drove them hard. They turbocharged the engine until they, you know, they blew a head gasket or broke a connecting rod, spun bearings. Like, none of these things were saved. So if you have a good one today, you have something that was maybe taken for granted at the time and very special today.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, those are both cool. I think if I had to choose between the Cyclone and the Typhoon, I probably choose the Typhoon, because the old joke with those cars was that even though they were trucks, the only thing they could haul was ass. So you may as well have the hatchback, you know?
There you go. More practical.
You can put things inside your fast truck.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a motorsports fan, and if there's one thing I love, it is the sound of an American V8 on a racetrack. And for me, nothing embodied that like Pano's Motorsports in the late 90s, taking, you know, Robert Yates NASCAR engines to Europe to race on road courses. And that was just the coolest thing on earth. So I couldn't drive that on the road, but they did make road cars. And the AIV Roadster for me, all aluminum, Ford Cobra V8, 300 horsepower, 2,500 pounds. It was like a little piece of that, like Pano's road racing dream that I could actually drive on the road. And although they only made 176 of them today, you can still get one for around $50,000, which is $15,000 less than it cost in 1998.
I completely forgot about those.
Everyone forgets about them.
I went down to the plant down in Georgia and filmed like two of them, three maybe. They were so cool. I feel ashamed. That was like a big part of my childhood.
That was all good.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I guess speaking of these crazy, like, supercar type things, Dodge Viper GTS.
Ooh, yes, yes.
Especially in the blue with the white stripes, double bubble roof. I mean, who doesn't love a massive V10 manual transmission and can kill you about 10 different ways?
Yeah, at least 10 different ways. I've never heard more people say that a car was out to get them than after they drive a Viper. Like, people talk about those 90s Vipers, especially with the 450 horsepower engines. They talk about those cars the way, like, bikers, motorcyclists talk about, like, world superbike leader bikes. Like, it will kill you if you don't know what you're doing.
Absolutely. And it will be fast. I know multiple people that totaled them.
It happened a lot.
Yeah, that's why it's hard to find them.
The funny thing is, if you think about it, it was a low compression LA-based engine with a manual transmission, rear wheel drive. That was probably the most reliable. Like, if you didn't crash it, that was probably the most reliable Chrysler product of the 90s.
Absolutely. I mean, just iconic, to say the least.
And still exciting. Like, people are like, oh, you know, 450 horsepower, whatever today. You know, a Bronco Raptor has 400 plus. No,
450 horsepower in that is a big difference.
It'll tire this wide and it'll break free if you sneeze on the accelerator. It requires like so much focus. Like, a C5 Corvette has inches more wheelbase than a Viper and 100 less horsepower. The Viper is so high strung, but it's gorgeous. I mean,
yeah,
that shape, for God's sakes.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And a surprisingly big hatch. You can put a lot of stuff in a Viper.
Yes.
And a racing pedigree. I mean, Vipers won everything from like Tommy Archer in World Challenge to the 24 Hours of Le Mans with the Orica team and the French drivers. Like, Vipers won everything on the road in the 90s.
It's just so sad that they're not making them anymore. They, you know, they stopped in 2017.
That sounds right.
Yeah, so give or take a year. But I mean, when you consider like what the fifth gen Viper was, came out in 13, you know, it was still very much raw. It was the nicest one they ever made, but you know, it had traction control, but that was about it. It was still pretty bare bones, but you know, there's really honestly no way that I can think of that car really could have evolved and kept its heritage.
Yeah, I agree. An automatic transmission or a dual clutch or all-wheel drive, like all these things that they could have added, I would rather see it die with honor
and
become like a celebrated collectible than like turn into what I don't like, turn into a Mitsubishi 3000 GT, which was cool, but it was not a sports car.
Right. Those were pretty neat, especially the VR4s.
Ooh, or the VR4 Spider with the retractable hardtop.
Oh, I've never seen one of those.
That was the one. That's if you can get one, that is the one.
What? That's sick.
And there was a time, like when I was down in Florida, where there was a place called like $5,000 cars, and one of those popped up on the lot, and I'm like, would I? What should I? Like, I thought about it. It was gone in 2 days. I never had the opportunity.
Oh man! Oh man! Hey, I got a weird one for you.
Let's hear it.
95 Buick Riviera.
That's on my list too. Like we both had the BMW.
Really?
We both have the Riviera. I love that car.
We're both equally odd. Yay! Yeah.
Everyone else like listening to this is like, what the hell is that? That was still
I know. So I used to own one of these cars, and no, I didn't have a supercharged one. It was just the naturally aspirated Series 2 3.8 V6. But that will always be one of my favorite cars, and I'll tell you why. It looked the outside I thought looked pretty cool. Some people think it looks like a fish. It looks really cool from the backside. The license plate actually got slipped in behind the taillight bezel, so you couldn't actually steal that license plate if you wanted to without popping the trunk loose. But the inside looked like a spaceship cockpit. The inside of that car was a very successful, like, reinterpretation of the Rivieras that you saw in like the mid-60s, how the dash was very wide and you had the flowing center console, but you know, it was the 90s. Everything was curvy and flowy in the 90s. So, you know, the dash flowed into the door panels and looked like it wrapped around the driver. He had these, you know, pie plate style gauges and stuff. And the seats, oh my gosh, the seats were so comfy and some of the best heated seats I've ever sat in. You know, the 3.8 wasn't a very powerful engine, but it was super reliable front wheel drive, and it got spectacular gas mileage. Just a really neat car, and it got even better towards the end of the life cycle.
And it's funny because you mentioned the way it looked from the back. I can remember the first time as a kid in the 90s, like one of those things snapped my head sideways, and I saw it going past, and I caught that rear end, and I'm like, oh my god, what is that? And so I kept looking for it, and I eventually found out, well, that's a Buick Riviera. And I remember the same thing about the interior. It seemed so enveloping and flight deck inspired. And it really did channel that first generation Riv from like 63 to 65 that had the hooded gauges like deeply set and the wraparound, the big console flowing. And, you know, it shared a platform with the old Zorora, which was a pretty good platform back in the 90s. That's back when they started using, like, design software and finite element analysis at GM. And so it was a very floaty ride. It wasn't designed to be a sports car, but the chassis itself was very rigid. All the compliance was in the suspension.
Oh, yeah. The Riviera or the Aurora was super cool. I mean, the Aurora actually had a slightly smaller displacement version of the Northstar V8, which Northstar V8s, you either get a good one or you get a really, really bad one. It just, you know, it's like playing Russian roulette. But I always, you know, if I had like unlimited money and resources, I always thought it would be so cool to take the Aurora or Aurora V8 or even a Northstar and shoehorn it in a Riviera and actually make a V8 coupe. That would be cool.
You know, that's kind of cool, but that's almost what the Eldorado was.
Like that. Yeah, that's true. I mean, like the styling of the Riviera.
I like the Riv too. I'll be honest. In the end, the Series 2 Supercharge gave you most of the performance, not of the L37, but of the standard 275 horsepower Northstar. The Northstar had top end, but the Series 2 Supercharged had the same low-end torque hit and almost the same absolute amount of torque. And that's one of the big problems with trying to find one of those Rivs these days. I can't tell you how many times I've tried to find one that's blue on blue or green on green, like inside out.
Blue on blue.
You can't find one with less than 100,000 miles. And I've seen 200,000 and 300,000. And, you know, their great mortal sin was that they just last forever and people drove them into the ground, unlike the Northstar. Which and blew up.
just like a lot of our favorite cars, it's hard to find parts for them, and, you know, cosmetic parts, stuff like that. Electronics start going bad. It's like, well, what do I do now?
That's one of the things, like when you see the wiring looms from 1990s cars and like the wiring loom is as thick as your wrist, you realize like, how much trouble the car restorer of like 2030 is going to be in.
Oh, just imagine stuff nowadays, if people are actually going to try. That's a big if. that's a discussion for a whole nother podcast right there.
You can have like a restoration shop. Some guy drives in with a 2002 7 Series. He's like, hey, can you fix my iDrive? No.
Nope. Shame on you. Just take it to the scrapyard now. Save yourself the trouble.
Hey, if the glass is good, part it out and sell the glass. Someone will want it somewhere.
There you go.
Okay, so I've got a car that used to be my dream car, and I've never driven it. I've seen it in person, and it's smaller than I expected, but the Vector W8.
Ooh.
This thing was the product of a industrial designer and car stylist named Gerald Weigert. And he was almost like the dog who finally catches the car. Like, what do you do once you've caught it? He spent 2 decades trying to raise money for this idea of an American-made supercar that would be built with all American parts, aerospace components whenever possible. And he actually got enough money via like fundraising and a stock offering in the 80s to start building it. A guy named David Koska did all the engineering. Weigert did all the design. And they managed to make about 20 to 22 of them. I think they had 2 prototypes that were turned into production cars. But it started with a blueprinted Roddick, like Chevy small block. And then they turbocharged it twice. And then they connected it to a modified Oldsmobile unified power plant from like a 1960s or 70s Toronado. And the whole thing was making 625 horsepower in 1992. It was mental.
Good gosh.
Yeah, which means it was an automatic transmission supercar too. That was also true. But there were screens in the cockpit. It had CRT displays from the F-117. Everything in the engine was CNC'd, steel braided hoses. Everything was countersunk rivets. It was like welded and adhesive bonded.
Unreal.
It was a crazy car. Oh my God. There was a time in around, I'd say 1999 to 2001, when these were selling for like 125, 130,000, people have actually figured out how special they are. And they're a lot more than that now. But still, go ahead and try to find any information. The only way I could find out about these cars back in the 90s was my library's back issues of Road and Track and Car and Driver. And then there was this German guy who was a super fan who put up a ton of stuff in German.
Wow. That's so cool.
It's just the wildest looking car. It looks like every single seam on that body could draw blood.
Wow. I've never seen one in person.
It's really small. Like, I thought it was going to be huge.
Really?
You know, you see a Lamborghini Diablo or like a Jaguar XJ220 and it's giant. You see the Vector and you're like, this is a lot closer in size to like a Porsche 911 than I expected. It really kind of jumps out at
you. Interesting.
How compact it was.
Wow. Well, shoot. The next car on my list is not even near as cool as that.
That's okay. As long as it's not a spooky X90, you're fine.
No. Buick Roadmaster Estate.
Ooh. Ooh.
And I guess, I guess you could say Caprice Estate and the rarest one of them all, apparently, Oldsmobile Custom Cruiser, which styling-wise, I'm going to go for the Roadmaster Estate with the fake wood on the side because, of course. but, you know, station wagons were such... I feel so weird talking about this when you were just talking about that cool Vector.
Okay. I mean, Wagoneers are cool now, right?
You know, exactly. It's all come back full circle. I mean, station wagons were such a staple in the automotive market for decades, especially in the 60s and 70s. I mean, even into the 80s as well. But, you know, in the 90s, the big body cars, they were just not as popular. You know, the rise of SUVs were taking over. You know, like nowadays, the rise of the crossover is taking over. And there's just something about being able to put your entire family into a car with rear-facing jump seats, which are not safe whatsoever. And it had an Astro roof in the back. You had a sunroof for the people in the back so they can look up and see things too. But I mean, they rode good. They had the same powertrain as the Impala SS that we were talking about before. So, I mean, they were not slow at all. And, you know, they even had different suspensions in the back too. Like if you get in and start really looking at some of the key differences, because, you know, they were a bit wider at the back, they were heavier and stuff, but, you know, some of those suspension changes actually made them handle not terrible. So they rode really good, and they actually could hold their own, especially when you're toting all your friends around. I mean, just neat cars.
You know, I think that's probably, along with the Riv, that's probably one of only two, like, Buicks from the 90s that is still, like, genuinely cool. And it might even be cooler now, because you can't LS swap a Riv, but you can LS swap the Roadmaster.
Yes. It had a 4L60 in it. Just make sure you got the right transmission controller, slap it on there with some motor mount adapters, and you're good to go.
Yeah, I mean, you've got so many options. You know, you can go with an LS swap. You can go with the 454 from, like, the Silverado SS. You do have, like, options of how you can build it. I do think that'll be a collectible. That was an interesting era, because that was the last generation of car that was built with, like, the World War II generation in mind. That was the last, like, generation of Buick that they were still young enough to drive before they gave up their driver's license. That was one more for, like, the person who would have bought a Buick with Dynaflow back in the mid-50s.
Right. Man. Oh, I can't wait to do a segment of talking about the 50s.
by the way, listeners, that's coming. We're doing all topics in car culture, car history, restoration diaries. You will see more here. If you're watching this online, put some comments in the description below. Talk about what you'd like us to talk about and give us some food for thought, so to speak. Okay.
This is going to be a lot of fun.
This is going to be cool. I'm going to go with something that is a little bit controversial, because it's not a cool car. It's not even close to a cool car.
Oh, I already love it.
Okay. In 1999, Honda launched the Insight in the U.S. market.
Oh, yes.
Think about it. This is a supercar. It's not a fast supercar, but what's a supercar? It's optimized for just one kind of performance. And that's what that first Insight was. All aluminum, super tapered, world record aerodynamics. It had the IMA combination three-cylinder engine with starternator, start-stop assist. This was a vehicle designed single-mindedly for one thing, and that one thing was 70 miles a gallon. They had some cool launch colors, like a really neat metallic green. And again, follow me here, but this was a high-performance vehicle. I'm embarrassed to say I actually thought it was cool.
No, those are super cool. And honestly, it's unfortunate you never see them anymore. And if you do, they are beat to the ground. But they lasted forever.
I mean, here's the thing. They've gone through two cycles of, like gas price surges. So back in 2008, when these cars were still relatively new, people were, flipping them to folks at higher prices, people who wanted to avoid what was then the unthinkable price of, like $4.25 a gallon.
Right.
Now we have the same thing, where there are people who just specialize in finding these things, doing the bare minimum to recondition them, and then flipping them to folks who are terrified by $5 gallon gas, which is like the new high. So they've been through like two rounds of owners who use them as like beaters.
Unreal. Isn't this fascinating how things, just go all over the place when it comes to some of these cars?
Yeah, and there was such diversity of cars in the 1990s. You know, you had the last cars being built with carburetors with like the 1991 Wagoneer, and then you had the first hybrids coming on at the end of the decade. And I just don't know, maybe the 1950s, that's probably the only other decade where you saw this much change from like the first year to the last year of the decade.
Well, it's like nowadays, the biggest thing is driver assistance technology, EVs, and all that. Like those are the buzzwords today, because, you know, every manufacturer makes some kind of crossover. Everything is starting to get a very generic shape and stuff. And, you know, there's really, you know, the technology is fascinating, and there is a wide range of offerings to choose from if you're in the new car market, but there is not a whole lot of diversity. In the 90s, you had serious diversity between what you were talking about and just the wide range of body styles, different types of vehicles, pretty much vehicles for every single person and interest out there. It's fascinating. Like you said, I mean, back in the 40s, you know, you had World War II, so there was a pause of things not being made. And then, you know, Studebaker was the first to come out with, you know, a new vehicle, but you still had a lot of similar designs through the late 40s. But in the 50s, that's when it boom, like all sorts of crazy things. And then you had the Finn era and all that. Anyway, I don't mean to take away from the 90s. I just really like the 50s.
We're going to go there. Make no mistake. We're going to go there. We're going to go back to 9 main bearings, straight 8 Packards, bullet nose and pre-bullet nose Studebakers, the Studebaker V8, which probably deserves its own show, but it'll probably be in our 50s episode. We'll get there, guys. I got one more 1990s car that I really adore, and there's only ever 100 made for the U.S. market. 50 were made as roadsters. 50 were made as coupes. It was the Jaguar XJRS. So to celebrate its two Le Mans victories in 1988 and 1990, Jaguar commissioned Tom Walkinshaw Racing, which had helped with a lot of those Jaguar Motorsports efforts, to create a version of the XJS that had a bored-out 6-liter engine, and it had 330 horsepower and 365 pound-feet of torque, which may not sound like a lot. But back in 1993, that was bonkers, especially from a Jag. And it's got those lovely, you know, XJS rear buttresses. It wasn't a fastback coupe. It wasn't a hard top. Those buttresses made it somewhere in between the two. It was the last generation of car to have a really low belt line before crash testing regulations resulted in like every car having a shoulder level belt line. This was like a car where you could really hang your elbow out. It wasn't designed for that, but it could do it. Everything about this thing, other than the automatic transmission, was optimized for performance. And, you know, it was the only XJS that I feel had a little bit of the spirit of the old XKE from the 60s.
That's pretty cool. I'd say the last thing on my list is Pontiac Firebird, fourth generation, specifically the Trans Am. Come out in 1997 or 8, 98. 98 is when the LS1 was put into the fourth gen cars.
Yes.
And I don't know what it is about Pontiac, but just for me, they always had just a little bit of a design edge over the Chevrolet counterparts, especially in the later ones, like 2002 Trans Am, I think the 10th anniversary model or something. I mean, just Ram Air hood, like just aggressive, just gnarly looking looks. And the, you know, I wasn't too big of a fan of the Chrysler Concord headlight Camaros, but that LS1 completely changed the fourth generation for the better. It was sweet.
Yeah, you could get Corvette levels of power pretty quickly just with some breathing mods. So you weren't really down that much horsepower and hardly any torque at all. There was something about that Firebird. I remember there was a test with like a Stalker radar gun performed by some magazine in the late 90s where they said that the hardest car to pick up was a black, no front license plate Trans Am. Precisely because there was nothing, there was no headlight during the daytime. There was nothing to reflect the laser back at the gun.
That's awesome.
Ooh, I forgot. SLP Firehawk. If you're going to buy one of those last
generations. That's what I was trying to remember. I couldn't remember the name.
Yes. If you want like 350 horsepower, exclusivity, you know, street legal performance, they were doing some mods that were sold out of Pontiac dealers. So it was all factory blessed. It wasn't aftermarket. And that's really the one to own if you can find it. You've still got the Ram Air. You've still got the, you know, the big nose, the schnoz that breathes. I kind of dig that for some reason. You're getting just a little bit more performance. And, you know, I think there are probably more F50s around than there are SLP Firehawks from the late 90s.
Probably.
All right. Guys, thank you for joining me and Kyle on this first four-wheel dive. There will be many more topics. Until then, if you're watching this on YouTube, let us know in the description below what you want to see. For those of you out on the platforms downloading this from the internet, you're going to want to check out Saab Kyle on YouTube. He's getting back to his original core focus of car reviews. You definitely want to sign up for that because this guy has experience and access like no one else. Kyle, you have any parting thoughts?
Oh, no, I'm looking forward to this. This is something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, the podcast in particular. And I'm really trying to branch out and creating new content. I've got all these project cars. I'm getting back in reviews. And, you know, cars are my life. It always has been and always will be. So I'm just looking forward to having some fun. So like Tim was saying, let us know in the comments below of certain topics that you want to hear about. And we're just looking forward to the next one. I'll keep you guys posted.
We'll see you guys on the road. Time out, Tim out, Kyle out. And thanks for logging on.